Hey, everybody. Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. It's boxing history time, my friends. We're back, which means I'm back with my dude, Aris Pina, CompuBox operator and fellow fight history lover like myself. Man, we're talking some good stuff today, Aris. How are you doing, man?
Everything's good, man. It's been a little bit of a minute since we did a history episode like this, but I'm really pumped about it because this is a good subject that I've been fascinated about for many of years. And, you know, I've talked your ear off about it. So it's good that we get to talk about it with everyone else now.
For sure, dude. I remember you've mentioned this guy to me a number of different times. And so I had to kind of brush up and whatnot, but there are a lot of interesting characters dragged into this story for sure. A lot of characters we know about already anyway, but it kind of falls under the umbrella of true crime, but like not really per se. It's just,
it weaves in and out of just things, yeah. But it's just more so just a fascinating, crazy life that was riddled with crime. Not like anything like insane, just, you know, a guy that fell on hard times and a lot of vices, but, you know, a lot of wasted potential too, you know what I mean? And just like you said, Pat, a guy that's just, his name, you know, caused the start of a lot of big, you know, famous people that went on to make history in the sport and a lot of stuff. So subject today is a guy by the name of Jeff Merritt, who went by the name of Candy Slim, a heavyweight that was, you know, prominent, I guess. His career started in the 60s, but really caught wind in the 70s. And someone I've always been fascinated about, you know, because there was just a lot of like hearsay about him, especially back in the early days, before like YouTube, before, you know, things of that, and before any type of footage came up, you know, there wasn't even a lot of articles written about him. You know, it was more so hearsay and all like the message boards of what was about his career and what could have happened and the reasons why X, Y, and Z didn't happen. But the main thing was that everybody just knew that he was a monster puncher, a guy that was scary, could have done tons of damage in the division, but unfortunately for different reasons, some of the outside the ring influences, some of them because of what happened inside the ring, he never got to reach his potential. And then he disappeared. That was another thing too. No one knew what really happened to him. You know, the last time anyone really saw him was in the early 90s. And there was all kinds of different theories of, oh no, he's dead. No, he ventured back to Vegas. Oh, he's doing this, or he's homeless or whatever, yada, yada, yada. So there was just a lot of mystery to a guy like that. And of course, I mean, I'm always intrigued by things like that. So I just was always trying to find new information on him. In recent years, there's been a lot of articles put out with a lot of information now out there about his past life, about the early parts of it, about his dealings in the, with his career, how, you know, guys were going to be bringing up how he was managed by guys like Joe Louis, how he was the start of Don King's career, how he was a stable of Angelo Dundee and Chris Dundee in Miami, how he was a part of intertwined with Muhammad Ali, also with a young Larry Holmes, Ernie Shavers. Like, there's so many different layers to this story. So, yeah, there's you know, a lot to it, but it's something that we're excited to talk about, and here we are.
And it's a fun era, too. It brings in a lot of...
It's one of my favorite eras, man. It's such a colorful era. Like, you're talking about the 60s, and you're talking about the 70s, and all the characters involved in that, and everything like that. So, yeah, man, it's just good.
Yeah, it's like really you have to understand this era a little bit to understand where we are now. I mean, I guess you kind of have to understand history at all if you want to understand where we are now in boxing. But this era especially is very pivotal in the sport's history. And of course, a lot of characters kind of came or rose out of this story. Like I said before, you mentioned Merritt to me a number of different times. And so, you know, I think a couple of good sources for material as far as reading is a guy named Steve Compton, who has written about Harry Greb. By the way, that was a coincidence, but a dude named Steve Compton, who's written about Harry Greb, and who's also a tape collector. He wrote for The Sweet Science a good 3-part article that has a lot of kind of his career information in it. If you want to know a little bit more about some of the details about his fights and a few quotes from fighters, but then also he's mentioned in that Don King kind of expose by Jack Newfield from a number of years ago too. Doesn't go into a ton of detail though. There's just a kind of like some paragraphs about it, and that's about it. And so also, as I like to do, I tried to find some new shit because I want it to be like worthwhile. You know, if anybody's actually trying to find out about Jeff Merritt, you know, I actually have some new shit that they wouldn't otherwise know unless they're really hardcore in the newspaper researching or something like that. So yeah, I think that it should be a pretty fun episode, but You know, like a lot of fighters, it starts in a not so nice place, dude. It starts in a very not nice place, Kansas City, dude. Kansas City, Missouri. We've talked about a number of different fighters kind of biographically from other places like Baltimore and the DC area, that which were really rough in their times, or talked about Detroit. We talked about, you know, the Kronk, a number of different Kronk fighters who, you know, just had really rough lives, who came from in or around Detroit, et cetera, et cetera. And Kansas City is probably underrated in that regard. You know, you often don't hear Kansas City mentioned among
from, like Brandon Rios and Victor Ortiz.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and from there are a number of you know, other celebrities and stuff like that, and sports people who have come from Kansas City. But it's a rough place, dude. That in St. Louis, there are pretty some pretty rough parts of those cities, and that's exactly where Jeff Merritt came from. And you know, one of the things that I was able to see that I kind of had to look for a while about, because I was just curious about his parents, about his family, and neither of those things are mentioned a ton. His dad died when he was five. I couldn't find out how, because I didn't see him mention how, but he said that his mom had a really, really difficult time raising him and his eight siblings. I mean, you know, it's Kansas City's no joke. You got nine kids, single mother. That's rough shit, dude. And that was the kind of, you know, that basically Jeff Merritt said that because of that, he and his siblings, you know, were raised on the street. You know, they were turned to the street pretty young. And yeah, that's kind of a common story for a lot of fighters, I think.
Absolutely. You know, and Merritt was like, that was mentioned in the article, even though he was big for his age, he was still like a very shy child and, you know, very conscious of the bullies and of the inner workings of his neighborhood. But instead of being a person that would, you know, that shyness that would let him, you know, get beat up by bullies and get bullied and stuff like that, instead he almost used that as like a defense mechanism that anyone ever came to him, he would just, you know, lash out, and because he was scared, you know what I mean? It just, you know, violence just took him over. And at the age of 15, he was already like 6 foot and weighed over 175 pounds. The guy was a light heavyweight at his age. Kind of like when, you know, in the same mold of a Mike Tyson, who you saw at the age of 13 and 14, who looked like a grown ass man, you know, and people, kids at that age who are built like that, and come from a really rough background, usually use that as an asset to do whatever the hell they want on the streets and run wild. And Merritt was no different. So that got him quickly into a reformatory at the age of 15. You know, that didn't take long.
And it's actually interesting, because one of the things that I also had not seen somewhere else was that he fought for in the early 1960s. He actually had already fought as an amateur before he gotten into any trouble. I think the common narrative is that he picked up boxing in prison, which is like kind of true. Like, he furthered his career in prison, but he did not pick up boxing in prison. He was already into sports, and he fought for a club called the Pan Am Boxing Club in Kansas City. And I guess this club is like, this is fairly obscure, because I couldn't find shit about it, dude. Like, there was like one other article where it was mentioned. And the only mention of it was that, like, it was for some other amateur show years earlier, you know, so-and-so of the Pan Am Boxing Club.
Okay.
That's it. And so, but apparently this place existed. However, that's not, you know, that's not really that crazy. Just think about, even just if you live in a fairly large city, how many fight clubs there are around your city, and how many pop up and they're gone next year, et cetera. It happens. So in any case, he had already started boxing by the time he was a fairly young teenager, and he'd gotten, you know, he'd kind of channeled himself, I suppose, into boxing, but it sounds like he was not able to focus that. And yeah, even at the age of 15, he had already started getting into some pretty serious trouble, man. You know, I couldn't find much about the rape charge, apparently, that is mentioned.
I didn't see much on that either.
I know Newfield mentions it in his book, and I'm not calling anybody a liar. I just couldn't find it. But there was definitely stuff about he was around drugs. He was getting hit with robbery charges and drug-related offense charges. And so basically he had gone in and out of custody, or in and out of trouble enough that he finally landed himself, you know, in like basically permanently in custody. in the system.
Well, yeah, by 1962, he's in the Missouri State Penitentiary, which coincidentally was the home of Sonny Liston, probably their most famous inmate. And at this point, this is, Merritt. And when he gets over there, this is when things start, the wheels start turning for him. Because like you said, he was already taking up boxing at this point, and, a street fighter and a guy that was just as big as his age, knew how to use his hands well, so he was well-to-do. But when he goes to the penitentiary over there, Liston soon after becomes heavyweight champion by knocking out Floyd Patterson. And because of that, becomes somewhat of an inspiration to guys like Merritt and others in the system. You know what I mean? And not only that, knowing that Liston comes from that same place that they're currently in, it gives them hope that they can come out. They're working in the same gym that Liston worked out. Hell, even when the heavy bags that Liston, used to use and had his name scribbled on and stuff like that, Merritt was working on. So he's having all this inspiration. Now his mind is getting solely focused on having an outlet or, something, he's not going to be able to get out of work, get out of jail, become a lawyer and do these other type of jobs that, society looks frown very badly upon, career criminals. Boxing welcomes whoever the hell they want, Open arms. So Merritt was finding an outlet. That doesn't mean to say that when he got out of jail, he was still having it, he became straight and narrow. If anything, that's definitely not. He was still getting in trouble. He was still getting arrested. It was a guy that just had problems, He just didn't really have that place, that focus, that someone was really going to direct him, that manager, someone that was going to be like, hey, listen, you don't have to do this. Here's money, here's this and that. We're going to guide you and try to put you in a certain direction over here. But soon enough, he would.
Yeah, and the, like, I think you mentioning Sonny Liston is pretty key there, dude, for sure, because Sonny Liston winning the heavyweight championship, obviously there's prestige and money that comes with winning the heavyweight championship or promoting, the person or managing or whatever, handling the person who won the heavyweight championship, et cetera. And so, yeah, like the idea that, that somebody could be reformed from prison, that there's money in that, all of a sudden that's not impossible. And so in 1967, Joe Louis and Sandy Sadler, among a couple of others, in the National Maritime Union, they visited the Missouri State Penitentiary, I guess because they had heard that Jeff Merritt and some others had made names for themselves fighting on these amateur shows that were sponsored by the Missouri State Penitentiary. And so there were actually a whole host of shows where the MSP literally hosted, sponsored, paid for these shows, and they would have other amateur teams come in, just like any other amateur show, when you pit one team against another or whatever, but they would have a handful of guys from the penitentiary fight facing, et cetera, some other team. But Joe Louis, who again, obviously was well removed from the heavyweight championship at this point, had come in with Sandy Sadler, who was also well removed from the featherweight championship, but Sandy Sadler had handled other fighters and had worked with a number of amateurs and stuff like that. And later worked with, George Foreman. Obviously they came in, they saw Jeff Merritt. I guess they had seen something in him. He was a massive dude, at 6'4", 6'5", had a fro, sideburns. Dude was looking scary. He's a heavy puncher, kind of held his hands low, was a free swinger, yes. Just a guy who you don't want to stand in front of somebody like that. Like very Deontay Wilderish,
Bombs immediate. Yes, very good comparison. He was a guy.
I mean, obviously they didn't look exactly the same, but it's just that you don't want to stand in front of somebody like that. Period.
If anything, Merritt was more of a free swinger than Wilder. Like Wilder, at least is much more reserved. Tries to set up his punches before he goes wild.
Yeah, he settled down. Merritt never did.
Yeah, Merritt never did. If you watch the few videos and the few footage out there of Merritt, you see the way he fights, like free swinging, hands down, like you said, just kind of swinging from the hip and trying to take you off your head with every punch. You know what I mean? Like, and not to say he was a wild slugger with no technique. There was technique there. He was a very, very talented fighter. But yeah, it was just, every punch was with mean intent to take you and put you into, the shadow realm.
Yeah, obviously, at the very least it's eye catching. You watch a fighter like that and it's like, you got to see what happens. Cause either they're getting knocked out or they're knocking somebody out. That's usually what happens. And so in any case, Joe Louis in particular, I guess, saw something in Jeff Merritt. And the plan initially, so this was in the summer of 1967. The plan was initially to get Jeff Merritt to the 1968 Olympics the following summer. And so they moved, the whole plan was, all right, we got to get Jeff Merritt paroled. He had served 2 years of, I think, like a 10-year sentence or something like that, or a 7-year sentence, something. It was a legitimate, you know, serious sentence. And he had served about 2 years, and they got him paroled. Joe Louis goes into court, speaks on his behalf. They have a whole team of people there who are looking like a bunch of professional ass fucking, you know, people sitting next to Joe Louis, et cetera, to make it look like, basically the point is to make it look like Jeff Merritt has something to do, somewhere to go if he gets released from prison. Yeah. That's the whole point. You know, we don't want this guy getting in trouble again. We don't want to see him back here, et cetera. So Joe Louis says, yes, we're going to, the National Maritime Union was a labor group. And so they could ostensibly get people jobs and stuff like that, get them good jobs, union jobs. And so that was the whole plan. Move Jeff Merritt to New York, get him a job, keep him busy, make sure that he's got money, you know, make sure he doesn't need to be getting into trouble, make sure he's training, et cetera, which is basically what he did. But
similar to Cloverleaf, no?
What's that?
Kind of similar to how Joe Frazier was backed by Cloverleaf, right?
Dude, you read my mind.
Oh, there you go.
No, you got it, dude. Ali with the Louisville business, yeah, group or whatever it was. Oscar Bonavena also had a syndicate that was backing him. Mm-hmm. And like basically these groups of people would get together and all pitch in money and they would invest.
Yeah.
And assuming that some fighter would eventually get to a championship, or if not get to a championship, get paid very well, and then you get your investment back, and then some. And so, like with Oscar Bonavena, Bill Gallo, the cartoonist, he fucking bought some stock, you know, in Bonavena. Harold Letterman bought stock in Bonavena. I mean, dude, a whole bunch of fucking people. It was wild. So, in any case, point being, yeah, like this is kind of how it went. Was Jeff Merritt went up to New York, and the plan was to set him up for the Olympics the following year. But instead, I think that I don't have an answer, but if I had to guess, my guess was that Louis and whomever else saw that Merritt was a bit of a firecracker, and they weren't really certain that they were going to get him through to the Olympics. Like, I don't know if that they thought he would last to the Olympics, you know? And so instead, he turned pro in 1968. And not too long after that, though, there were some changes.
They were, man. First off, early in his career, he was featured in Madison Square Garden, you know, where a lot of guys are always dreamed to want to be fighting, stuff like that. Merritt early on, you know, got put on there quickly. And first off, when he was there, you know, he scored some knockouts and he was looking really good. But then, you know, he ended up slipping up really quickly. But on the undercard George Chavallo fighting Manuel Ramos, Joe Frazier sparring partner by the name of Jerry Goss scored a big upset over Merritt. But back then too, like when today, when, you know, people think, oh my God, you know, when a prospect gets like flattened and everyone's like, oh, well, that's the end of the world or nothing like that. Back in the late 60s, 1968, 1969, it wasn't the end of the world. Prospects lost. That's how you learn, if anything, that gave Merritt the experience that he needed to shake off the cobwebs to keep on going with his career. But like you said, soon after that though, man, the writing was on the wall with him. And Merritt, like you said, outside of the ring issues, things like that nature. And the syndicate realized that, you know, there was going to have to be some changes. Plus, Merritt was getting a little bit annoyed with it, too. It was kind of becoming like a two-way type of strife. This would become a reoccurring theme with Merritt. Whoever he was involved in, he would get very, very aggravated with, feeling he wasn't getting enough fights, he wasn't getting paid enough, yada, yada, yada. You know, each one escalated, especially when he gets to Don King later on. We're about to get to that soon enough, but, you know, this would become a theme. But at this point, it looks like Merritt's going to be moving to Miami.
Yeah, basically, excuse me. Yeah, I think that, like I said, it's, and like you also said, his inability to just kind of stay focused, his propensity for getting into trouble, It just started taking over, dude. Like, and getting to New York, you could see that very early on in his career, that he fought at the National Maritime Union Hall like a whole bunch of times. And I would imagine that that had some sort of connection to the Lewis and Sadler and stuff like that. And then in his first fight at Madison Square Garden is that Johnny Gauss loss. And it's kind of like, I think that that might have been what influenced, you know, obviously a loss didn't mean nearly as much then, but it probably did influence what they were doing with his career. Like, all right, dude, you know, you fought at the National Maritime blah, blah, blah place a number of times. And then your first time we get you to the Garden, you lose. Like, that's not looking so great for you, kid. You know, maybe we need to dial it back a little bit. But, you know, they take him back to the Union Hall. But at the same time, I think the plan all along, you know, he had been talking to the press and stuff like that. Anytime he mentioned something was like, oh, you know, I want to fight some big name. I want to fight Foreman. I want to fight this person or that person, you know. So they had to keep him moving. And he's a heavyweight. He's a big heavyweight. He's a hard-hitting heavyweight. It's all about that momentum, you know. And so, yeah, they brought him back. He fought at the Felt Forum. He got a couple of pretty decent wins against, like, Roy Williams, for instance, when he was
– That's a good win.
Yeah, when he was undefeated, you know, he took his O. That's not massive, but that's a pretty good win. And I think something that if you're developing a guy like Jeff Merritt's career, you're thinking, okay, all right, we got him back on track. We're, you know, we're moving along here. But, dude, the trouble, too much, far too much. And you can see that he's starting to slow down just a teeny bit activity-wise. And then all of a sudden, the venue shifts to Miami Beach. And that's because down in Miami Beach, were the Dundees. You got Angelo Dundee and Chris Dundee, who were both, you know, promoters and managers in addition to Angelo being trainer. And so they had basically, and, you know, it's potentially some icky connections down there, you know, but I mean, they were very well connected in the boxing community, period. They knew a lot of people. There were always fighters coming in and out of the Fifth Street gym. And on top of that, always heavyweights too, name heavyweights who were sparring with Ali. And so there was a high quality of opposition going through Miami Beach. Really, Merritt was probably lucky that was the direction that he went in. I mean, because compared to other places he could have gone, I guess, you know, that's a pretty good place to go.
Oh, most definitely. You know, his last fight in MSG was against a guy named Henry Clark, and that was a very, very solid win for him, because Clark, despite his record of not looking impressive at that point, of only being 17-5, had been in with a who's who of guys at that point, including monsters like Sonny Liston. And for Merritt to be able to get a decision over him, albeit Clark, you know, was a late replacement and always said afterwards that he wasn't, you know, fully prepared for a fight like that, was still a good win on his record. So yeah, he had momentum moving on to Miami. But like you said, you know, I think the syndicate and everyone else would just want their hands clean with him, because they realized the loss was going to be much worse, you know, much greater than the reward. So like you said, he moves on to Miami, and actually gains a big following over there. You know, because he's a big knockout puncher. Like you said, he's big, he's burly, he's scary. Miami loves that type of scene anyways. And, you know, punches have always thrived over there. And the Dundees, they know how to promote their guys and keep them active. So Merritt was doing his thing. And he was scoring good wins against, again, if you look at his record, it's guys that, you know, they don't have great wins, they don't have great records, but they were good journeymen and, you know, serviceable guys for the era of the early 70s. Guys like Stanford Harris, guys like Charlie Polite, they didn't have great records, but they were in with a who's who of, you can imagine if you look at their records, and they usually went rounds with most of these guys, and Merritt was blowing them out. So he did have momentum and things were looking good for him as well, but his outside the ring issues, like you said, Pat, were starting to take shape. And it wasn't so much him getting into crime and doing a bunch of other stuff, but, you know, eventually things started coming to light that people didn't even realize that. Was the fact that, you know, he had an addiction to drugs, primarily heroin.
Yeah, he had, I don't know where he picked it up, but honestly, the time that he was
said it was when he was young, I believe, right?
Well, and the time that he was doing and the place that he was doing time, I wouldn't be shocked if he picked it up in prison, or if at least it got worse in prison. You know, heroin in the 1960s and 70s had started getting big, so it's not really a shock that that might happen. But yeah, I don't know where he got it, but that was always the rumors, that he was really into heroin, but he also smoked weed, and that he was just basically into drugs for the most part. You know, he had a lot of shit.
If it was going to get him high, he would do it. Like he did, he smoked weed. He would drink coughs. He would even drink cough syrup, a lot of that, to try to get
that's
him
right. High. That's true. Yeah, I read that too. So I mean, that's a sign of somebody with a pretty serious addiction if you're drinking cough syrup.
Yeah, yeah. I would say he had a few vices or two. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not with my dime store psychology here, but he obviously was trying to mask a lot of the shit, a lot of the pain that had happened to him in his life. So,
but that's what the problem is that a lot of these guys, you know, we've heard of a lot of fighters who have always been able to hide their addictions or to a degree, especially in the heavyweight division. You know, you have, for example, Michael Dokes, who had an insane cocaine addiction that eventually unraveled his career. But, you know, before then, he was still able to ascend to become WBA heavyweight champion. Pinklin Thomas is another example. You know, Pinklin Thomas was an alcoholic by the time he was like 10, 12 years old, and then, you know, picked up heroin only a year or two after that. By all accounts, he was using it throughout his career. You clean up a little bit here and there, but he was using it, you know, even all throughout his reign. And then he really started falling apart, hitting the skids in the late 80s, early 90s, when it became apparent he had issues. But, you know, that's the thing with these guys, is that, like, they're able to hide their addictions or their vices. Merritt, not so much. But that's why it looks, you know, at this point, he had to take a break. And that's when, you know, he kind of fell out of Miami. And when something like that happens, you know, it's kind of like with his career, it's in limbo. You know, he's been aligned with a lot of people. There's been a lot of promise there where people are just like, wow, man, you know, there could be something going on with his career. And like, he has, you know, at this point too, when he's in Miami, obviously he's been sparring with Ali. He was working with others and doing good sparring with Ali too. There was always rumors that, you know, Merritt was like, you know, was able to hurt Ali. Ali said otherwise, but those, you know, Merritt was doing good out there, but like you said, his vices outside the ring started fucking him up, and he had to take a little bit of time off. So by the time he has his last fight in Miami, which is in 1972, he takes off more than a year. And at this point, he's losing, you know, he switches over management, and at this now, a new player comes into the picture. And this new person is a young, bombastic guy who's freshly out of jail, former numbers player in Cleveland. Hustler, you know, probably a guy that ends up being perfect for the sport, and he's trying to make inroads. He just promoted a show in Cleveland for the hospital. I guess that was the charity event featuring Muhammad Ali, and he realized he can make a lot of money in this, and you know, so now he's going to get his roads in. This guy was named Don King, and Don King had his eyes on three guys. He had his eyes on Ernie Shavers. He had his eyes on Jeff Merritt. And there was a third individual, his name escapes me off the top of my head, but
it was in the Newfield book. I can't remember off, I can't remember right now, but yeah, there was, I could tell you right now. Here, give me just one sec and I'll tell you who it was. But yeah, there was actually, I'll fill in real briefly. Yes. There were just like small blanks. Some dude named Bill Perry, I guess, had purchased Merritt's contract at some point. But then a separate syndicate had bought. So there was kind of a first syndicate or what, our first group of people, but then a second syndicate, which was Joe Lewis, Bob Arum. And also it included comedian Henny Youngman, who for some people might be like, who's that? It's the king of the one-liners from Goodfellas. You know, I try to take my wife everywhere, but she finds her way home. That guy, you know, he was big in like the 50s and 60s and shit, and probably big among like mobsters or some shit, ostensibly or sure, imaginarily. But anyway, he was part of this syndicate who had bought the contract from this dude named Bill Perry. But then he had gone, you know, to in 1972, he had, I guess, kept sparring in Miami, even though he, from what I understand, it wasn't explicit, but it sounded like the Dundees were like, good fighter, but pass. Like, we're not going to get involved with this guy.
You and know, that's like, saying something, isn't it? Not to cut you off, but think about that, because if you think about Miami, the Dundees, and we've taught me, you, Gray, Corey, all of us, we've talked about the seedy, seedy ass scene that was going on in Miami and the fighters and the aliases and all the different things going on back then, for them to pass up on a guy and be like, you know what, we're not going to touch that, says something.
I think that they could tell he was trouble, that he had problems and that he was inconsistent. Like when you could get him to the gym and work, like he was great, but he might not show up one day, you know, he just might just
especially
not
when they,
show
when they
up.
Were dealing heavily with a guy like Jeff Sims a decade later.
Well, and they were already, their attention was already focused toward Ali, I'm sure, you know, to some degree. And Chris, I think, was handling a number of other fighters, but, you know, Angie especially was on Ali, but he still was sparring there. It's not like he couldn't, you know, he was still there and hanging out. And the sparring session that you're talking about with Ali was in 1972. And that was the one that kind of, I guess, lives on in mythology, that Ali's like, no, here's what happened. I figured him out. And Jeff Merritt was like, nah, beat his fucking ass. Shut up. You know, so who knows? You know, Ali had gotten beaten up in sparring a number of different times and blah, blah, blah. But this, who gives a shit? The whole point is that apparently Bundini Brown, according to the folklore, was the one who introduced Jeff Merritt to Don King. And that Don King, like you said, had been handling this kind of charity event for Ali. And even in those charity events, just like decades earlier, there was a lot of money changing hands, dude. And there was a lot of, you know, probably funky accounting. You know what I'm saying? Like there's a lot of fucking O's being fixed in for napkins and shit like that. So
I can just see Don King's wheel, the wheel spinning in his head.
Yeah, dude, his just looking at this wheelbarrow of money going by and going.
And like the things and just being involved in being around a guy of Ali's stature and like, the, you know, having the notoriety of becoming famous because of this. Like, you just know every like, he's like, wait a minute.
You just know that he was thinking, in 4 decades, I'm never going to take this jean jacket off. In 4 decades, I'll have 3 fucking jars of candy sitting on my desk.
Dude, that jean jacket, even back in 07, the first time I saw him in person, that jean jacket was already faded as hell. And just like the rhinestones were falling off of it. And it was just frayed on the sides. And I'm like, bro, you got money, Don. At least just update it. You can do something with it. Put some stones back in it. Something.
Dude, you know that shit just smells like broken contracts and fighter misery.
Yeah. Probably cognac too.
It makes sense, dude. You know, you see Don King, I'm sure that just like anybody, like Arum, like just about any big promoter has had that moment where they're like, dude, I could make some fucking money doing this. And sure enough, you know, Don King got into it in pretty short order, dude.
And the thing about Don King is that like Don King was actually perfect for Merritt. Merritt was a street guy. Everyone that was aligned with him beforehand that handled his career were business people, more or less. And even guys like Joe Lewis were not a person that could really relate to Merritt because they weren't from the same background as his. You know what I mean? Don King was. Don King was a street guy. He just, you know, he did time for a murder when he stomped a guy to death. He was a numbers runner. He was involved in gangsters and hustling. And, just,
and it was,
you know,
Ray Anderson.
Ray Anderson. Yeah. There you go. So
that was the third guy.
Yep. So Don King was just a hustler his whole life. He was a street guy his whole life. He knew how to relate to people like Merritt. He knew how to talk to them. You know, I mean, he knew how to motivate them to get them into the type of mindset that needed them to succeed. So, yeah, Don was probably perfect for Merritt at that point. Obviously, he was going to screw him over, as we found out that'd be a reoccurring theme throughout his life and career. But at that point in time, this looked like it was going to be the perfect fit. And early on, when Merritt made his comeback, it certainly looked that way, too.
Yeah, dude, you know, it's crazy, too, because the guy that you brought up earlier, Henry Clark, very experienced dude, but in 1974, so they rematched in 1974, and Merritt lost to Henry Clark. And at that point in 1974, two of King's key fighters in Jeff Merritt and Ernie Shavers had lost in the span of just a few months. And Ernie Shavers was to Jerry Quarry, which we had talked about in the Quarry family episode. So, I mean, you know, this was a massive blow, but the whole point is that like you go through Jeff Merritt's career at this point, right? Like he does not have a long career. You go from where he's in Miami Beach. And so Don King pretty quickly brings him back up north on the East Coast, and he gets a pretty key win over Ernie Terrell. Granted, it's 1973, but a pretty key win over Ernie Terrell at the Garden, and it's first round TKO, which pretty much nobody was expecting. Like people might have said, "Oh, well, Jeff Merritt might get him," but they weren't expecting him to run through him like that.
And that was on the undercard of not the undercard. That was the main fight at MSG, but that was also they showed the closed circuit of Ali Norton.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. That was a big win. Like you said, man, Terrell had definitely seen better days at that point, and he himself was on a comeback. You know, Terrell was a decade removed probably from his days of being a top contender and obviously years removed from briefly being WBA heavyweight champion. But at this point in time, when he came back, it was one of those fights that was like a crossroads. Terrell had lost to... Chuck Wepner before that, and what was I've never watched it, but by all accounts was just a straight up out and out robbery. And so at this point, you know, it was like expected. Trell was one of those guys that, you know, he goes rounds, like you don't really knock him out. The only time he was stopped before that was, I believe, against Cleveland Williams. So when the fight starts and everything, Terrell, you know, tries to do the whole clutch and grab. Like, he was one of those guys that was very awkward, like probably sit in well with the any type of era, especially the big guys later on, with the same clinching style that you would see John Ruiz and the Klitschko's and others like that. But Merritt just had that crackling left hook. You know what I mean? That was his best punch. Type of punch that could shatter jaws, break speed bags, heavy bags, and just, you know, cause havoc among everybody. It caught Terrell. Terrell went to another world that he had no idea what the fuck just happened to him. Merritt pounced on him. Terrell didn't go down, but, you know, he was kind of hovering in a corner just looking like Kingfish Levinsky against Joe Louis. You know, that famous photo when he's just like, coward.
Yeah.
Same thing. So
just overwhelmed. Yeah.
Completely overwhelmed.
Like I was saying earlier, you know, Merritt's one of those kinds of guys where you can't let him get going. Like, you can't let it start. You know, you got to either nip it in the bud or just stay away. Like, get the fuck away and let him tire out or something, because that's all you got. You can't meet him head on. You know, it's going to be a bad idea.
And if you do, it's like, dude, it's like you said, bad news bears. The guy just he chucked, all right? He wasn't there to go over there and try to, you know, jab you, whatever. No, he walked in there and he was swinging some wood. Like, you know, and they're just, if he had you hurt and he was already a nasty guy to begin with, and he probably didn't, you know, was dismissing you, it was like a person smelling blood, you know what I mean? Like, if a pit bull just finding a piece of meat that he was going to tear up, and you just...
Yeah, dude, he was the kind of guy that was just so mean in the ring, and you couldn't let him get going.
Because he was mean Terrell outside did. The ring, too. He was mean outside of the ring, too. You know, here's the story, as you mentioned, Pat, that an interesting side bit. You mentioned that how we're about to mention the Henry Clark fight in a second, but around that time also, when when Ernie Shavers, his stablemate, was getting ready to fight Jerry Quarry, that was the biggest fight of Don King's career up until that point. You know what I mean? Like, he had Shavers was a huge puncher. I'm not sure. Did Shavers already knock out Jimmy Ellis before he fought Quarry? I believe so, right?
I want to say yes. Positive, but I want to say it's 72.
So, you know, Shavers had momentum and everything like that. But when there was a sparring session, that's the thing. That's the main key component right here. There was a key sparring session. So Merritt and Shavers, being stablemates, they used to spar often. And Merritt always resented Shavers for a few reasons. One, he always felt that Don King was giving Shavers special treatment and giving him more attention than Merritt did. Like we said, a reoccurring theme in his life, he always felt that his managers and promoters weren't really paying attention to him. Two, he always felt that Shavers used to take it rough on him in sparring. Shavers was a notorious guy in sparring. Everyone would always say, whoever sparred with him, that Shavers was not a guy that really held back and more or less would really put a whooping on whoever tried to, you know, get in with him. A guy that hit his sides hard as Shavers, I get it. For example, in the rematch with Larry Holmes, the poor sparring partners had to have pieces of tape placed against their headgear. And in Sharpie, it said Holmes across it, because that gave Shavers extra motivation to punch their faces in.
Jesus, dude, can you imagine the poor motherfucker soiling himself as somebody's like writing Holmes on there? You're like, well, yo, what are you doing?
Like, bro, really? They may as well just put an X on my head, the bandana, and give me a cigarette in
like
my
he's
mouth.
Already gonna beat my ass. Like, now yeah. You're just gonna fucking make sure I can't have children. What the fuck?
You're like, hey, hold up, Bobby, come here really quick. Excuse me, what's happening here, guys? I can't see. What's going on? Don't worry about it.
Brutal, dude. Absolutely brutal. You
know
what?
You go in the mirror and you look and you see Holmes ablazing across your skull and you just wait. You fuck sure, that. Guys? I didn't sign up for this. How much am I going to get paid?
Yeah, fuck that, dude. Making the minimum, making like $200 a week or something like that, dude. You're fuck that.
I mean, you weren't making at least sparring partner money. I mean, I'm sure you weren't getting paid like peanuts, but like, how many of those guys spent like a couple of days there just getting their brains rattled? And they were just like, you know what? It's really not worth it. I want to see my kids in 15 years. Like,
yeah, and they're probably part of the Don King heavyweight factory too. So it's like, who knows what they were getting paid? Who knows what they're getting paid?
That's what Merritt was having to go through. That was Shavers in the late 70s beating the shit out of these guys. All right. This is him in the early 70s when he still had the hair and the Fu Manchu going on. Really scary. So Merritt said that Shavers would bully him, you know, beat him up and everything like that, which by all accounts sounds about right. So Merritt had a lot of, you know, venom built up in him. A lot, you know, he was definitely pissed off. And as a guy who was already bitter and pissed off and angry as Merritt was at life, didn't really take a lot for him to get it, you know, to seek vengeance.
And you know what, though, dude? I have to say that, like, again, my fucking thrift store psychology class here, dude. All right, man. I got a couple semesters of community college under my belt, all right? Yeah.
Take it down.
But for real, like, that's some crackhead type shit behavior, though, dude. Like, when people Absolutely. Are helping you, and I'm not saying that Don King didn't fuck him, but like you said, it's like it was a recurring theme throughout his career where he would constantly like bite the hand that fed him. And that's like crackhead type of behavior, dude, where like, you know, somebody's helping you and you're just like, you're not helping me enough type of shit. And it's like, bro, you're destroying my life and yours. And despite that, I'm helping you. What the fuck? But that's the kind of shit that he did throughout his career. And that kind of, I think, boosts the claim that he was probably under the influence or addicted to something for much of that time.
Absolutely. You know,
absolutely no question.
I'm only trying to help him. Don said, I'm not siding completely with Don here, but Don
exactly, yeah.
did say over and over that there was times he actively did try to help him. He did get him back on track. He put him in with proper management, got him like in shape, got him a place to live, like, you know, tried to get his life in order. And these weren't like non-high profile fights he was putting men. These were high profile fights. Like Ernie Terrell was a high profile fight at MSG. His very next fight, which is on YouTube.
He might have been calling in favors for the fights, you know, King yeah. that is, you know what I'm saying?
And because especially at this point too, King is still young. Like he's still breaking in his career. So if anything, he's wanting success for his guys so he can make an impact, not trying to actively screw guys early on. I mean, he always has his eyes on the prize. And you can clearly see, okay, the first time he won, loses, he's going to, like, wash him away and concentrate on something else. But if his guys are winning and he's still early in his career, he's going to keep on trying to, like, motivate that because he's young and hungry himself. He wants dominance. So
and it almost makes me wonder, though. So, like, so we move forward and we get to, well, actually, you posted some footage of it. So it's worth mentioning because it's Ron Stander and Joe Frazier beat the absolute fucking piss out of Ron Stander. So, I mean, that's mostly his claim to fame. I'm not trying to be rude, but
yeah, if you watch this and you're not really familiar with Ron Stander, you probably would remember him during the Terrence Crawford Uriurkis Gamboa card, yeah, where he was showing the audience and God bless Ron, man.
Yeah,
he
nah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm doing it out of love. I'm doing it out of love.
No, we all are, man. You know what I mean? He was sitting there and he finally getting the adulation of all the fans around him, all these drunk fans. And Ron probably had a few beers himself. You know what I mean? He's feeling it.
Fucking bless
he
him,
had the
bro.
Overalls on,
you deserve
right?
He's it, buddy.
The way he's looking, he's like, yeah.
He's like, oh, shit, yeah. And then fucking feeling it, you know?
Yeah, really feeling it. So, I mean, good for him. He was a guy that fought a who's who of more or less everybody back
and
in the
just
day.
Got battered.
Battered by them all. The only, you know, somehow he scored a knockout over Ernie Shavers, but I assume, again, I don't even think footage of that fight exists, but I assume that's that was more like a Homer Simpson fighting a boxcar guy that episode. Like Shavers just hit him till he got exhausted.
Yeah, just outlasted him. Yeah. Somehow stayed up. Yeah. So, I mean,
Stander could take a beating. Even Joe Frazier, who cut him up and it looked like a roadside map when he was done, couldn't knock him down. So what we're getting is that Merritt not only was he beat the hell out of Stander, he dropped him. He dropped him twice. Apparently, they said that was the first time Stander was ever dropped. And dude, it's hard to watch, man, because like it's just a straight up massacre. You know what I mean?
It's like you brought up the Simpsons. It's like the stop. He's already dead. Like it's like a beating where you're just like, okay, oh hey, stop it. What the fuck?
And you can tell Merritt is relishing it. Like he is just so into just pummeling this dude. He walks in, douche.
Oh,
off uppercuts, the left, they're like
it's when they have like contempt. They're like, oh, you're gonna fucking stay up, fine. Yeah. Then I'm gonna hit you again. Like, oh my god.
And Stander, and you see a couple of Standers shaking his head, no. And so Merritt's like, okay, boom, and finally,
oh no, okay.
He's getting knocked
eat
around
some more then.
Yeah, and then finally he drops like a log, gets up, gets dropped again. And he's laying there, and then you see Merritt coldly walk away with his hands up, and you're like, fuck, man, he's a scary individual. Like, this is a guy that's going to be a reckon with in division. Everyone is like excited because, you know, he's tall.
This is a good run.
Yeah, he's lanky. He has monstrous power. He has you know, the coldness of Sonny Liston. And who's going to stop him? You know what I mean? The only person at that point that was exhibiting anything like that was George Foreman. You know, so. That's where things were hopefully were heading, especially where King was hoping to bring them. But what we're getting at, I don't even think we brought up the sparring session again. We got to go back to that again. Like, so to bring that up, what really happened, and to bring up this coldness of Merritt, when Shavers was getting ready to fight Jerry Corey for the first time, Merritt gets brought in to spar him again. At this point, Merritt now is a heavyweight himself, who's, you know, in the same stable and everything like that. And he's pissed off.
And it would have been right around this time too, after the Stander fight. So yes, it's like, we're exactly. Yeah.
We're right around intertwined at this point, and Merritt got a chip on his shoulder, and he's like, you know what, it's time for a little bit of payback. So they get in there, and they're rumbling. They're rumbling hard, and they're going back and forth. Shavers had a bad tendency of keeping his mouth open a lot when he was throwing punches, or just in general. He's breathed with his mouth open. And they were always warning him about that, telling him, don't do that shit, it's going to get you, you know, it's going to mess you up one day. And sure enough, Merritt threw one of his left hooks, probably on purpose, because like you said, you know, you shouldn't have. It's kind of like a, you know, a bitch move, not a bitch move, like just one of those salty moves where you just kind of like really kind of take, you can, you know, you probably could have done something a little bit better than ruining your boy's chances for a big payday. But Merritt throws a left hook, a sucker shot, you know, and cracks Shaver's jaw in like a few different places, completely just breaks it, you know, and ruins Shaver's, at that point, his potential chance at Corey, which would have been the biggest fight of his career. So Don King is livid. He's absolutely furious. He immediately fires Archie Moore, who was working with Shavers at that point. He's like, why would you do something like that? Why would you let them spar? You know Merritt's a psychopath. Whatever. Gil Clancy, who was handling Jerry Corey, he's flabbergasted by the whole thing himself, too, because he kind of knew, you know, everybody's familiar with Merritt and knowing how much of a hothead he is, and knowing that it was probably stupid that he put them in as a sparring session so close to a fight. And he tells Merritt the same thing. Listen, Clancy said something to the effect of, you don't spar. He was like, you don't spar with Jeff Merritt. You only fight him for money. Why would you do that?
And even years later, so Don King fired Archie Moore, mm-hmm. and as Ernie Shaver's trainer. And I mean, there was speculation at the time, even though Shaver's like, he never really seemed to have super great punch resistance, especially if you could hang on a few rounds. You know, there was a good chance you could just outlast him. You know, it might not even take big punches to take him down, because he was just, it would like get exhausted. It wasn't even that his chin was awful necessarily. But even so, you know, there was some speculation that injury obviously made his jaw worse and made his punch resistance worse. And so then when Don King also, as a response, fired Archie Moore, because Archie Moore had some questions about what was going on, Don King basically went to the press and was like, no, Archie wasn't following, you know, doing what I was telling him to do. And Archie was just doing what he wanted to do. So I fired him. He can't stick around camp and blah, blah, blah. And years later, Ernie Shavers was like, that fucked me up too, because I loved Archie. And Archie was like, you know, my trainer. And Don King just got rid of him. And like, you know, I didn't want that.
And it became a reoccurring thing for Don's career too. You know what I mean? Yep. Hey, by the way, my son's your manager now. By the way, I want you to get rid of this guy. And Aaron Snowell's your trainer.
Yeah,
or Richie Giacchetti's your trainer.
He did that to a whole bunch of fighters, just installing these, you know, people who were loyal to him or would keep tabs on a fighter or whatever. did it a whole number of times. And that's what he did to Ernie Shavers too. And so, I mean, you know, Ernie Shavers in the same camp basically as Jeff Merritt, because they're stable mates. And you could see just already the kind of chaos and inconsistency going on at the behest of Don King at this point. And so then going into this Henry Clark rematch, you know, I think that it was clear that Jeff Merritt was hot. You know, he was definitely on a good streak. A number of opponents weren't super great, but between Ernie Terrell and Ron Stander, they were two either ranked or just outside of ranked contenders. So, yeah, I mean, you could see him, you could see why getting some get back or getting, you know, back in the ring with a Henry Clark, why that would make sense. You know, Henry Clark, super experienced, you know, you could gauge where you are in your career against a guy like that. But apparently, you know, you could also just step on a fucking landmine too.
And that opened up a thing that a lot of people weren't aware of, was that Jeff Merritt had a chin of a silly putty. You know, like a lot of monster punches, sometimes if you can get through and get to them, you can hurt them. And so Henry Clark, like we said, their first fight, he loses a competitive decision to Merritt, but he hung tough and threw it. And he always was bitter about that fight. And he always mentioned that too, because like we said, he came in as a last minute replacement and he wasn't even really in shape and he wasn't prepared for the style or anything like that. And so, you know, he lost the decision. So he always maintained that if he was in tip top shape for that fight and was actually prepared, he was going to put a whooping on Clark. He was going to put a whooping on Jeff Merritt, and he was clamoring for that fight. So as the rematch happens in 1974, Clark has been around for a long time at this point. He's not a top contender. He's more of a fringe contender. If you're going to get, you know, if you're going to move on to the upper echelon of the division, you're going to have to get through him. And it won't be easy, because Clark was a guy that you just didn't knock out quickly. Only guys like Ernie Shavers and, Sonny Liston, shows you how far back Clark went, and guys of that nature were able to stop him. But so Clark came in with a chip on his shoulder. So when they have this rematch now, and it's on YouTube too, it's not great footage, but because it's kind of like a far away angle and everything, but you can see the body language right away. Clark is like hyped. You just see him. He's like boiling in the corner. And a guy who patterned himself off of a style like Muhammad Ali and of that nature as a boxer who moved and wasn't really a big puncher. He came in like he was Mike Tyson that night. Like he definitely was feeling a certain type of way. And Merritt came in almost more relaxed. You know what I mean? The same kind of like the lanky, free swinging style that he always kept, but even more so, it just seemed like he's just a little off, you know what I mean? Something's just not quite there with him. And as they start up, you know, Clark right away jumps out the gate and then boom, hits him with a screaming shot that Merritt just flats out of it and has no idea what the hell just happened to him. And more or less the fight's over after that. Clark just sweeps him up.
You know, and also kind of weaving in and out of this entire tale, like, you know, the last several years that we've talked about of Merritt's career, he was also going in and out of trouble. Most of it, like, kind of medium, you know, like not major. It would be like he'd get picked up for suspicion of X, Y, or Z and then get let off, or, you know, get picked up for something else, but then, like, you know, get charged with something else unrelated or whatever. And so he had been still getting into trouble, but his connections, also having Don King around, you know, Don King also had connections, et cetera. So he was able to kind of skirt his way around the major trouble for the most part. But this loss was big, dude. This loss definitely seemed to break something in him. But also, I don't want to speculate anything about, like, you know, brain injuries. I don't know anything about that. But it certainly seemed like this was a turning point in his life. Perhaps it was less a brain injury and more the realization that he probably wasn't going to be a champion. And that
A shocking thing. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, a reality. For a guy that you originally beat and you go in there and you're riding high at the highest point of your career now, in a fight you're probably thinking you're already overconfident.
You've had Joe Louis, Sandy Sadler, you know, this dude who was just with, you know, fucking around with Don King, the team that was, you know, or Muhammad Ali, you know, the Muhammad Ali's entire team was like, you know, you've been in his gym.
Everybody is clamoring about it. Everybody's so singing it's crazy.
You're that shit was probably a real hard crash, you know?
A huge one, because it only lasted less than a minute. You know, no, Henry Clark is not a guy who knocked out people in 30 seconds. This was not Mike Tyson. This was not Ernie Shavers. This was not like a massive, this was not Wilder, all right? He was a boxer primarily. He didn't even score a lot of knockouts in his career. Sure, he could sting you a little bit, but he was just a pesky boxer with a good chin. He was not a knockout puncher. So for Jeff Merritt to get flattened in 47 seconds that badly, that's a tremendous blow to your career. That would really affect anybody. And people would just kind of be like, whoa, you know, like, all right, then we got to take a step back and pump the brakes a little bit. And unfortunately, this was the first instance, and this is what created all the bitterness with Jeff Merritt, is this is the first instance where you saw Don King was just like, oh, look at that. You know, I got damaged goods now. Sweep that to the side and let me see what I can pick up over here. Here, come here. Like, you know, and Merritt, who already was feeling abandonment issues throughout his career, a guy that's already, you know, feeling bitter about management and people not really taking care of him and thinking that, you know, conspiracies and X, Y, and Z, and a person that has all the out of the ring issues that he does, that's just going to fuel the fire. If anything, it's going to fuel it even more so because he felt so connected with Don. And, you know, a person like Don King, who just knows how to like tap into your inner, into your inner self by saying everything that you want to hear and saying everything that you need to hear and making you believe that he really gives a shit and that he wants to be a father figure to you, that's going to even hurt you even more so. So I can't even imagine what was going through Merritt's head at that point with his career in a tailspin. So, with that happening right there, that's when the things when he was talking about when he was riding with Larry Holmes and other stuff. And there was like a part in his book, in Larry Holmes's book, where him and Merritt are riding together. I think they might have been sparring or training or whatever it was, but they were riding together. And Merritt told Holmes, hey, man, take me to a neighborhood to go buy some weed. And Holmes is like, okay, you know, wasn't going to tell him no. So, you know, they go out and, Holmes was like, you know, I grew up rough. He's like, I know homeboys. I could find what he needed. So it wasn't difficult. And so they went and they found him. Merritt bought some stuff. And I think he went to go buy some cough syrup too, right? So Merritt's drinking that. He's smoking and everything. And they're in the car together. And Holmes is just kind of like, yeah. And Holmes just kind of like, yeah, okay, sure. Like, you know, like, what the fuck?
So let's listen to some music, huh?
Yeah, yeah. That's when Merritt was actively planning to kill Don King. Like, I tried to find the article. There was a really thorough article about it on boxing.com. And I wish that website was still around because there was a lot of really good information from a lot of historians, right?
Ted Sarris, who recently passed away, was one of the guys who wrote for boxing.com. Yeah.
But there was a lot of good, like, really, really good historical articles on guys that usually don't get a lot of ink.
Yeah. So, that's true. Yeah.
Merritt was one of them. And they talked a lot about that, though, like the whole Holmes situation. It was kind of funny to read about because I can't even imagine being in that situation where a guy kind of strong arms you'd be like, yo, man, drive me around and go buy a weed. And you're like, well, sure. And while you're in there, you're hearing about how he wants to actively murder your promoter. And you're just like, what? But and he almost did it. Like Merritt, like I had a full on plan where he was going to go to King's house and like do X, Y, and Z and just take him out. But you know, clearly that didn't happen. But again, that fight, the Henry Clark fight, really sent Merritt's career into a tailspin again. Like, you know, the momentum he had when he first came back and when King signed him and he stopped Ernie Terrell, he stops Ron Stander, and then he gets knocked out by Henry Clark. King drops him. He's like, whatever. But when he comes back again, hold up, you got to see, I believe this was actually on a King card on this next one. I might be wrong. Let me find out. Well, it actually was, see? After all the stuff he was saying about King and all the other things, and, you know, he falls off, he comes back again in 1976 on the undercard of George Foreman, Scott LeDoux.
Yeah, he had apparently stayed on speaking terms with King, despite the fact that, so he loses to, just make sure I get the dates correct here. So when he lost to Henry Clark, it was March of 1974, about 6 months later or so, he was pulled over in a car and he was suspected of armed robbery. And he was, I believe, acquitted of that or let off on that, but then picked up for something else, like in short order. And basically, he was identified in some other crime or something like that. And long story short, he had served a little bit of time again, but then when he had found his way out, he went back to Don King And Don King was like, sure. And was like, you know, oh, yeah, I'll put you on the undercard of some, you know, some whatever.
Yeah.
Not a good idea. You know, I mean, it seemed like Avalanche Stan Ward would have been a fairly safe, you know, person to put him in with, generally speaking, but no.
You would have thought so. Again, you know, Stan Ward, at this point, he's only 5-0. Stan Ward would become one of those guys that, how would you explain it? He probably would be a better contender in any other era, but he was stuck not so much in the golden era of the 70s, because I think he started peaking and came of age in the late 70s when, you know, a lot of those guys were slowing down. But that being said, those guys were still active. And Ward, who fought out of the California area, the LA area, Sacramento, you know, good all around, but, you know, limited experience when he was already thrown to the Wolves, was just, you know, a level below a lot of those guys. Like, he fought Mike Weaver, yeah. He fought Ron Lyle, fought a lot of who's who. Yeah,
he obviously had nobody like looking out for his career like that.
Exactly.
Because he was just put in with whomever, you know.
He really was. He was thrown in with a lot of guys from beginning to end. And but to his credit too, I mean, like, he still had a decent career. Like, it wasn't bad. And, you know, for a guy, he's still remembered today. Like, you know, hardcores will talk about, oh yeah, yeah, Stan Ward was a good fighter. Anyways, when he was at 5-0, this wasn't any, none of that was supposed to happen. This was supposed to be just the easy bump on the road for Jeff Merritt to make his comeback. And then eventually, maybe if he looked impressive enough, Foreman's on the comeback as well, match him up with Foreman, you know, so-and-so, whatever. Doesn't happen.
Yeah, he had, so Merritt had himself had talked about potentially getting in there with Frazier, Foreman, you know, it's that era, you know, you just start mentioning these big names. Really, you just say the name Ali and reporters just come running, you know, people, what?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, he just started calling out names and shit like that. And I it still made sense at that point. Like, he still had only lost early in his career into Henry Clark. So it's kind of like, you know, it's still, you know, you can conceivably, he can get back into contention. All right, you spend some time in prison, it'd be okay. You know, he had some time off, it'll come back. But it's just, we've already seen his limitations, not only as a person, you know, he's had a lot of outside the ring trouble, but as a fighter, he's limited, and he's limited by a jaw that just is not holding up. And so, yeah, that style. And on top of that, the inactivity could not have helped, you know, coming off of a bad loss. And then the style that we're seeing where he's driving headlong into making these guys who are not big punchers, big punchers. Yeah, dude, it was bad.
And, you know, the stuff he was probably doing outside the ring too, you know, he was definitely dealing with a lot of demons and his drug issues. So he comes back in. Ward at this point is young and he's very hungry and motivated. And I believe this was probably the first time he was featured, you know, on a network television on a major undercard like this. So yeah, he knows what he has in front of him. He knows the opportunity he had. So he took what was in front of him and blasted him out. And like I said, went on to have a respectable career after that. Merritt's career, on the other hand, was ruined, shattered. You know, the Ward fight was the nail in the coffin. It wasn't ended. It wasn't over yet. He still had a couple of more fights in him, but more or less, in terms of him ever doing anything or potential of doing anything, done.
Yeah, I mean, like the dude that he gets in with later on that year, Billy Daniels, is another guy who fought literally everybody around that time.
Not Buster's dad.
What's that?
Not Buster's dad.
But yeah, Columbus, Billy Daniels.
Wait, that was Buster's dad?
No,
that's what I said. Yeah.
No.
Oh, Billy Daniels. Wait, whoa. Excuse me.
No, he fought.
Billy Daniels that fought Ali and everybody else?
Yeah, he fought like everybody.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Billy Daniels was that guy, the like heavyweight.
Everybody.
Everybody. He was like a long, long. Yeah, he was around.
Yeah,
forever.
He was like at like 500, not even 500, but like, oh no, okay, a little over 500. But he fought like everybody.
And
just about everybody that he stepped in with that was any good, he lost to. Like, you know, he went undefeated early on in his career against mostly nobodies, and then pretty much like just started getting whooped on.
Zora Foley, Doug Jones, a young Ali,
everybody. Yeah, and so, but I mean, like, I guess, all right, fine. You know, you get in with Billy Daniels and like, all right, here's your chance, dude. Just get a win, you know, get your career back on the right track. It's still 1976, you know, it's still, I guess, a comeback or whatever. And he comes back a couple months later. But also, you have to remember, dude, he turned pro in 1968. This is 1976, 8 years later, and this is his 24th fight, 25th fight. That's pretty inactive. You know what I mean? So I think that it's pretty clear that it's inconsistent. And even against Billy Daniels, dude, he musters a draw, a 10-round draw. And
And that's bad because at that point, you shouldn't be fighting a draw with Billy Daniels, who
no.
at his record was getting stopped in the first round by most of the guys he was fighting.
Yeah. And if you're any good at all, you beat him.
Probably would have knocked him out, yeah.
Yeah. If you're any good at all, you beat him. And yeah, so I mean, another just kind of shock to the system, I think, dude. And again, getting in and out of trouble, it's going right back into the cycle, dude. Going right back to, I guess, what he knows or what he has to do to make money or whatever. And also his addiction. So I mean, finally, after getting into trouble so many times, he basically earns his way, pretty much way into prison for a number of years again. You know what I mean? It's like he can't stay out of the system.
Totally. I that's when, like you said, he kind of like disappears for a while, and that's when like the mystery of whatever happened to him. His last fight was a card promoted by Bundini Brown, who was still around at that point in the early 80s. Ali train had obviously ended, but it was just a nondescript KO, KO win over somebody. And but like you said, yeah, he went free falling back into like a bunch of drugs and getting in trouble with the law and things of that nature. He would surface around, like, he ended up, I guess, in back in Vegas. His whole family more or less moved to Vegas, right? And he ends up over there, and he would resurface from time to time. But most notably, we're gonna fast forward now to around 1991. And that's where we mentioned earlier about the Jack Newfield book, because Newfield, who wrote the scathing expose on Don King, and if you listen to the show, I'm sure that you've definitely read the book. It's a very, very, very good book that Newfield wrote, one of my favorites. And I've read it cover to cover a few times. I know you have. Like, it's anything you want to know about Don King, it's in there. And trust me, it's good because Don King hated it. All right. There's, the video footage out there of Don King visibly confronting Newfield, threatening him, screaming at him. Carl King saying to him, and I quote, yelling, "I'm not my daddy. I'll kick your fucking ass." And and Newfield, because he was a Brooklyn dude and didn't give a shit and wasn't gonna back down from anybody, asking King over and over, "Why did you take money from South Africa?" Asking about the Sol Kerstin deal with Sun City. And King is going back and forth with him, "I don't need to say anything, you blah 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 blah," and going on and on and on and on and on. So this was all around the time of Tyson Razor Ruddock. I'm not sure if it was the first fight or the second fight. Do you know which one it was?
To be honest, I don't know, but my guess would be the second,
Second, right?
based on like the design of the book and shit like that, but I'm not positive.
So as he's there, Newfield's still trying to get info on the book and all that. Don King threatened him. Don King's posse threatening to kill him. All this other stuff. People trying to take away his credentials. Newfield comes across, of all people, Jeff Merritt. Jeff Merritt was hanging around Vegas at that point. He was outside of a hotel. Not sure which one it was, but they said he was outside of a hotel. And there was varying accounts. A lot of people always said that he was homeless because he looked it. Come to find out that he actually wasn't. I don't know if he was staying with his mother or he was staying with somebody at that point, but he very looked really disheveled, still big as hell, obviously, but he looked disheveled, he looked weak, kind of gaunt. No shoes on, dirty, just everything like that. And he was outside the hotel, obviously where a lot of the boxing people were hanging out and scrummage and stuff like that. And Merrill was over there yelling up and ranting and raving about Don King and talking about who he was and all this stuff. And then at one point, Newfield caught the attention and noticed what was going on and walked up to him and approached him and said, "Excuse me," and he goes, "Are you Jeff Merritt?" And Merritt said, "Yeah, I'm Candy Slim, give me a dollar."
Which was apparently his tagline for peddling for money, at least according to Newfield.
That's what he said. He would walk around the people and say, "Don't you know who I am, man? Don't you remember me? I'm Don King's first fighter. I'm Candy Slim. You know who I am. Give me some money.
Brutal, dude.
And I mean, I would definitely give him money. If he came up to me, I'm Don King's first fighter, whatever. First off, I'd probably give him a few bucks just to calm him down. And second, I would probably want to ask him some questions to see where his head is at with that, because I'd be curious. Which I think Newfield tried to do as well.
Yeah, and it sounded like he didn't really get too far. Like, yeah. You know, he didn't really get, and it sounded like Merritt was not in a position to, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly, he was a little out of it by that point. Yeah,
properly explain anything.
But that's where the story got fascinating, because that was literally the last time anyone had seen him. And then years later, fast forward about, you know, so that happened around 91. Fast forward 15 years later or so. So we're like, you know, in the mid 2000s. And there's the message boards, and there's a lot of, like, you know, the early days of boxing websites out there. And once in a while you would see them. Hey, whatever happened to Jeff Merritt? Anyone knows what happened to Jeff Merritt? Anyone remember Jeff Merritt? And then it would always get a lot of responses. Oh man, I remember Jeff Merritt. Everyone would just be like, God, he was scary as hell. He was doing this, he was doing that. And then the whole central theme would be like, what the hell happened to him? No one knew what happened to him, you know? That was always the main thing. It was kind of like, you know, the last time anyone had seen him or anyone had heard anything of him was when Newfield wrote that book. So it was always kind of speculation. Oh, he died years ago. Oh, you know, he got his leg amputated and he's living homeless in Vegas, still peddling money on the streets. Oh, he's living with his family somewhere. He's doing this, he's doing that. Like, no one really knew anything. And that made me even curious, because I wanted to know so much about him. I couldn't even find that much on his career. Like, you get the little tidbits and you get like the bullet notes and stuff like that. But I couldn't find anything that was like really substantial and meaty on him, you know? I talked to Steve Farhood about him a little bit. And Steve actually, I believe, was ringside the night that Merritt, you know, ravaged Ernie Terrell at the Garden. And he talked about how scary and intimidating it was. And shows you how far back Steve goes, right? And so there was like people I would talk to, and they all talked about him, like, you know, saying, yeah, he had the potential and he was really crazy, but no one really knew like a lot. He was shrouded in mystery. So I'm thankful now, these past few years, it finally seems like the fucking peel, the layers of the onion are starting to be peeled off, you know? People started finding out, oh, he actually was still alive. He didn't die. Oh, he was still in bad shape, but he was doing X, Y, and Z, you know, out in Vegas. Okay, here's other parts of his career we weren't aware of. Here's this, here's that. And then here we are today.
Yeah, and there's really not much, like you said. Overall, it seems like for the most part, he was kind of a forgotten character. And it was actually that article by Steve Compton. He seems to put together some of the pieces. It sounds like he did some interviews. So he did do some legwork on this. I don't want to, you know, discount that at all. According to Steve Compton, though, Jeff Merritt was arrested for like the final time in 1998, because it was just like, dude, you've got like a billion arrests in your life. You're just going to go to prison now.
You're a criminal.
And so he was sent to prison, and then while in prison, he suffered a stroke. And if that happens, generally, like, they would just sooner release you, because then they have to take care of you, and then that costs money. I mean,
yeah,
who already sounds cynical, but that's right? that's just the fucking truth. So they let him out of prison, and in 2014, I guess his condition had devolved to the point where he was needing constant care by his sister, which is, you know, a common story, unfortunately, as well in boxing. And he finally passed away in 2014 in June. And I mean, so not necessarily, you know, he definitely did not go out with a roar. He went out with more of a whisper, unfortunately. Definitely not the way that he fought, needless to say. But that's kind of the story of Jeff Merritt, dude, where he just faded out.
And it stinks too, because, you know, there's been a resurgence in recent years with guys in the media going out and doing interviews with various like forgotten boxing people. Like, we can, you know, Trish Dixon has done like this podcast that he's done that, you know, focusing on a lot of guys, forgotten guys, and a lot of other people have done that as well. We talk about them all the time on our show. And it stinks because a guy like Merritt would have been perfect to reminisce about his career, to get interviewed about, you know what I mean? Like a person like Leroy Caldwell, who's been completely forgotten about, a heavyweight journeyman and fought a who's who of everybody. You can find interviews with him now online. You can find interviews with Edwin Virouet online. You can find interviews with all these other guys from the past that are kind of been forgotten, but people sometimes seek them out and be like, hey, let's talk about your career. And they're more than willing to, because who the hell has wanted to talk to them for the past 30 years, you know? And if Merritt, you know, had kept him, had got himself together and, you know, had stayed healthy over the years or whatever, I think he would have been an absolutely fascinating subject to talk about. You know, considering all the people, all the players he was involved in, all the people he was involved in, the different things that were involved with his career. My God, man, could have wrote a book on this shit.
You know, you tell me this shit more than once a year, but it especially comes around when International Boxing Hall of Fame Week comes around, that it's important to talk to these people while they're here, that it's
It
important
is.
to meet them while they're here, and it's important to get their stories while they can still tell them. And similarly, extending out to the non-champions like Jeff Merritt, like a Leroy Caldwell, you know, the guys who saw a ton and who would really help fill in the pieces and whose stories are really no less important than a lot of these other celebrities. They just have different stories to tell. You know, the stories that Jeff Merritt could tell in 2022? You fucking kidding me, bro? You know, just it would be unreal, dude. The type of stuff that he's seen and that he went through. Not even necessarily boxing related, just the life experience, bro. So yeah, it sucks that he, you know, went out as he did. I guess he would have been born around 1947 or so, because there's not a birth date on his box rec page. But
So he would have been in what, his late 70s today, early 80s or so,
yeah,
close to.
he would have been well, so let's see, 1947, 75 ish. So I mean, you know,
Around Larry Holmes's age, you know,
yeah,
foreman.
not young, but I mean certainly not fucking decrepit, and to most human beings still in a state to be able to communicate and to, you know. So
Totally.
yeah, it's unfortunate that he went out the way that he did. And if nothing else, the things that we talk about and the fighters that we talk about should also illustrate that we need to do a better job of taking care of fighters when they're on the downside of their career, on the other side of their career, and
Absolutely.
remembering fighters, you know. And I mean, we're doing about as much as we can given our circumstances, but it's important to remember these guys
It's
and
true.
ladies.
Yes. Not to get too much of a, like a downer over here, but like when I was home a couple of weeks ago and I had a pair of boxing gloves hanging in my room that I got at the that I got autographed at the Hall of Fame. We're talking like 2001, right? And I'm looking at that, I'm looking at those gloves, and I was going through the names, and I realized now, and it actually hit me. I was like, holy shit, I didn't even think about it. Dude, 95% of the guys that signed those gloves are gone. Of the people that signed those gloves have since passed away. Like,
Yeah.
they're all gone, you know? Famous former champions, contenders, referees, trainers, you name it, whoever signed it, like they're, most of them are gone. You know what I mean? Like, that's how this, it's, it is what it is. And it's like, yeah, you gotta take the time out. You gotta reach out to these people. And you don't know. You know, I go on BoxRec and I see a lot of these guys today, and I'll look at their records and they were still active like in the early 80s and whatever. So I'm like, oh, are they still around? And then you find out they passed away in 2017, they won 2018, 2019. And it's like, damn it, you know, you just missed it. And you're like, too bad I couldn't hear their story. Like a dude like Ron Stander. I don't know. I never actively looked up for his interviews. I know I'm probably sure he was interviewed from, but like, look at how many dudes he fought and all the career he went through. And he had a long ass career that lasted up until like 1980, 81 or so, you know, the stories he could tell about the shit he was doing. So it's like,
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously there's nothing we can do about the fighters who are gone except for
we
tell
need to
their
talk about them.
stories.
Exactly. I think we're doing a hell of a job, hopefully.
But yeah, like you said, like I said, there are fighters who are still here. So it's good to hear their stories. Like you said, Triz Dixon, he's doing a really good job of making sure that many of these fighters' stories are told. But yeah, dude, I appreciate you. You know, coming together with me and trying to make sure that these fighters' legacies, whatever remains of them, stay alive and that people know about them, dude. Thank you for sure.
Holy man, it's blessed.
All right, well, everybody, thank you so much. If you listened in on the podcast, go ahead and subscribe whichever podcast app or website you wind up listening through, we appreciate that. But also, if you watched on YouTube, subscribe and say hello, leave a comment, try to respond. And also, as far as social media goes, the Knuckles and Gloves podcast is on social media like Facebook and Instagram, but we're also on Twitter, Knuckles N Gloves, because, you know, character limit, what do you want me to do? But individually, we're also there. My buddy Aris Pina is there on Twitter as Punch Zone Aris. I'm there on Twitter as Patrick M. Connor. So say hello. We'll say hi back. And Aris, we'll talk soon, bro.
Have a good one, y'all.
Later, everybody.